The Tom Woods Show, episode 1813.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Harry's Razors, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, has a special offer for you guys. You can get a Harry's starter set for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. That's a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover, all for just $3. Head over to harrys.com/woods to claim your offer. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here, talking about the virus today. We actually have a lot of ground to cover today, and in particular, we're going to be at least beginning the conversation with a discussion of what's been happening in the courts in terms of challenging the various COVID restrictions from a religious liberty perspective, because, of course, the churches have been under particular restrictions, in many cases far more unreasonable than other entities have had to deal with. But there's a lot more we're going to be talking about in this episode today, and I'm particularly pleased to be able to welcome as my guest today, Chris Ferrara, who is special counsel with the Thomas More Society and who has, in fact, got some legal victories under his belt in this very area. Now, it's particularly noteworthy that I'm talking to Chris because Chris and I wrote a book together a long time ago, probably 2002, called The Great Facade, about the Second Vatican Council and the craziness that unfolded in its wake in the Catholic Church. And then, a few years later, we had rather an unfortunate public falling out, let's say, that was not always super friendly. I guess that's the nature of a falling out. And we just did not communicate for a long time. I think we went at least a dozen years without talking. So this conversation that we're about to have is actually the first spoken conversation that Chris and I have had in over a dozen years. And I'm really pleased that we're doing this. So in any case, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, thanks. It's good to get the band back together again after all these years.
Yeah, this is really something. I guess what happened was I did an episode of this podcast however many months ago on the case you won in New York, the religious liberty case. And I thought it was a very, very interesting topic. And I was really glad for your success, not only for you personally, but of course for us as a society. And I guess your son, you know, so the young people, I'll tell you, they know the score, what's going on, must have alerted you to the fact that I had done this. So you wrote to me, and then we had a very pleasant correspondence after that. And you more or less came to the conclusion, as I did, that look, you know, there's only so many years allotted to us on this earth, and doggone it, there's a lot of work to be done. And when possible, it's good for people of goodwill to be at peace with one another.
Right. We have our differences, and I'm sure the differences will remain, but we have also a lot in common. And I think this is the time when you have to forge alliances with everyone that you can forge an alliance with, because these are the times that try men's souls. I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I never anticipated a situation like this being brought on by a virus of all things.
And anybody who might have speculated about something like this would have been the sort of person, you know, at a conference, I would have whispered to you and said, oh, get a load of that guy over there. You know, it turns out I owe that guy an apology, it turns out.
Well, I've been telling my sons in particular, well, five of them, that you're going to see things that have never been seen before. And I was predicting this years ago. And they were, you know, they were scoffing at the time, but they're not scoffing anymore. Now they realize this time of ours really is different in terms of the intensity of the societal and civilizational crisis that we're in the middle of. You know, Pius XII said in 1950, the condition of the world is worse now than it was before the flood. Today, he'd be reduced to a state of apoplexy.
Yeah, no kidding.
What's happening right now, it's just, it's beyond imagining. Not even I imagined it. You know, it's gotten so bad that, you know, the opposition to Trump, to take one example of our situation, has reached the point where you see a meme like the one I just saw an hour ago, where they want to make it illegal to own pigeons because they might communicate with each other concerning Trump's agenda. You can't have a carrier pigeon.
Oh,
I mean, you know, and you and I have talked about the whole issue of capitalism, but I think we both agree that these behemoths in the social media are really not capitalism. They're quasi-governmental entities at this point.
Jeez, and all this time when dealing with them, I always felt like my one out was I could get a carrier pigeon in the last resort. Now they're even taking that away from me. Good.
We'll be back to samizdat, the printed word.
This is just unbelievable, honestly. And yeah, now is the time to go back and collect your, you know, friends from yesteryear, because man, yeah, do we need to be working together at a time like this? Well, I want to talk about, even though I did do an episode on it, now that I have you here, let's talk about that case. So first of all, what was the name of the case?
Well, I have three of them, actually. One in New York, one in New Jersey, and one in California.
Oh, the California one, I guess I must not have known about.
Yeah, they're all involving the same theme, which is a challenge to various restrictions imposed on entire populations in the name of, quote, containing the virus, unquote. An effort that, of course, has been an absolute failure. And so all of these challenges involve restrictions on houses of worship. So each of them is unique in that there's an alliance between Orthodox Jews and traditionalist Catholics. And the parallels between the two constituencies are really quite striking. So the Orthodox Jew, like the traditionalist Catholic, is an outcast within his own religious constituency. He's backstabbed by his own fellow religionists. He's considered the Taliban of his religion, and so on and so forth. But these are the people who have the courage to stand up and challenge these restrictions while the mainstream religionists cower in the background. So in all three cases, we've got a combination of Orthodox Jews and priests of the Society of St. Pius X. And in all three cases, we've achieved significant victories by means of this alliance. And it just, you know, it just looks good. You're not just representing your own constituency. You're not special pleading on behalf of Catholics. You're basically showing that believers of all kinds have been suffering unbelievably under these restrictions, which are absolutely preposterous. So in all three cases, New York, New Jersey, California, we're challenging capacity limits on churches. And also the challenge is now expanding to include the social distancing nonsense and the absolutely absurd mask mandate. That's the next phase of the challenge.
I recall Bill de Blasio commenting on all this and saying, well, I understand, in effect, maybe a handful of people are unhappy, but the fact is, I consulted with the religious leadership of the church in New York when drafting these regulations. And the thing is, I don't doubt that. Is it actually the case that Cardinal, why am I drawing a blank on the Archbishop of New York? Dolan?
Hey, of course, me to draw a blank.
Yeah, he's such a non-entity. I can't even remember.
Yeah, Dolan.
Yeah. So was Dolan, in fact, just going along with this?
Of course.
I assume, yeah, yeah.
Of course, because, you know, the mainstream Catholic Church is only too happy to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and also to give to Caesar what is God's. So that's what's happening. They're bending over backwards to abide by these restrictions. But there's an irony here, because the breakthrough with the Supreme Court actually came in a challenge by Bishop DiMarzio of Brooklyn Diocese. What happened was he was challenging the capacity restrictions under something called the Cluster Action Initiative of Governor Cuomo. This is a big subject, but the Cluster Action Initiative is the next phase of the big scam of the virus-related lockdowns. First, it was, you know, flatten the curve. Well, the curve disappeared sometime in June. Then it was contain the virus. Well, the virus has pretty much been contained in terms of deaths and hospitalizations. So now it's the Cluster Action Initiative. What is the Cluster Action Initiative? Well, they go around, they test every fool who's willing to be tested with the polymerase chain reaction test or PCR test. They run 35 or 40 cycles. They find some remnant of RNA or DNA, and they declare that a case of COVID-19 without a clinical illness. These are not cases at all. They're just positive test results that in most cases mean absolutely nothing in terms of an infectious disease. And then they set a metric. They say, well, if a certain percentage of the PCR tests in a certain area is X, then we shut down businesses and churches in that area. So you have the red zone, the orange zone, and the yellow zone. So in that case, Bishop DiMarzio challenged the restriction in the red zone and the orange zone. In the red zone, you can only have 10 people in your church maximum, and in the orange zone, 25 people in your church at a maximum, putting aside the percentage limits. So they went to the Supreme Court just challenging the 10 and 25 person caps, but they didn't challenge the percentage limitations. Apparently, they were quite content to have their churches limited to 25% or 30%. 33% of occupancy. They just had a complaint about the 10 to 25-person cap. So the Supreme Court came in and said those caps are unsustainable under the free exercise clause. And it granted Bishop DiMarzio and also Agudath Israel, an organization of synagogues, an injunction against enforcement of these caps pending an appeal to the Second Circuit. So they took the appeal to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit wouldn't give them a temporary injunction. So they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court gave them an injunction. And after that, you know, in a way, the dam broke. So now we have different applications, including my own application to the Thomas More Society with our Supreme Court counsel for an injunction pending appeal. And what the Supreme Court's doing now in light of the Brooklyn Diocese case is saying the 10 and 25 person cap idea, that's a dead letter. As far as percentage limits, we're vacating any denial of injunctive relief by the lower courts and sending it back to the lower courts to reconsider even these percentage limitations. Because favored businesses like factories, meatpacking plants, retail, grocery stores, liquor stores, bakeries, you name it, there's a long list of favored businesses, either don't have those percentage limits or more generous percentage limits. So now all the lower courts are being forced to reconsider the whole scheme of restricting churches more harshly than favored businesses. And we've made a lot of gains. So we can talk about other cases too. I have the Jersey case and the California case, all involving pretty much the same type of legal challenge.
And in general, the results have been...
Well, in New York, in the case of Robinson versus Murphy, Robinson's the lead plaintiff, a priest of the Society of St. Pius X. Back in June, the judge issued an injunction in our favor. He said in June, you have to treat churches the same way you treat so-called phase two industries, which are favored businesses. And they're all at 50% capacity. So why should churches alone be at 25% capacity? So he struck that down and gave us an injunction saying we have to be treated the same way as favored businesses, 50% capacity, which was a huge win at the time. Then, of course, Cuomo, not content with his original regime, came in with this thing I mentioned earlier, the cluster action initiative. He says there are clusters of cases based on PCR test results. So he superimposed over the original restrictions this cluster action initiative. And he said you can't have more than 10 people in a synagogue in the red zone or other house of worship. And in the orange zone, there were more than 25 people. Well, we challenged that as well. And the same judge who gave us the injunction back in June, for some reason, upheld this. So we appealed to the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit, following Brooklyn Diocese, said, nope, that's got to go back to the original district court judge. He now has to reconsider upholding the cluster action initiative in terms of these capacity limits. So now we're going to ask the judge in the New York case to just basically treat us as essential businesses. Houses of worship, churches and synagogues should essentially be at 100%, like factories, meatpacking plants, mass transit vehicles crammed with people and all kinds of other places. Or at the very least, at least 50%. So that's where we are in New York. In California, following the Brooklyn Diocese case, we a state judge enjoined totally the capacity restrictions on churches in California and said basically it's 100% for churches, the way it is for favored businesses. State of California has just appealed that. But interestingly enough, the county of Los Angeles, where the Pius X priest there, Father Burford, has a couple of churches, dropped all its restrictions on churches. They're now at 100% capacity because of the original Supreme Court case in Brooklyn Diocese. So we have a win there. Then turning to New Jersey, Robinson versus Murphy, the plaintiff there has received a vacator and remand. In other words, it's been sent back to the district court, which denied us an injunction. And now we're going to ask the district court to give us the same limitations on church activities that are allowed for favored businesses. And the Supreme Court has made it clear in these cases that henceforth, you can't treat religious institutions more harshly than businesses on the theory that the businesses are essential and churches are not. That's just a dead letter now. So we see some light at the end of the tunnel on the capacity limitations. But next up is the floating personal bubble zone, Tom. You know, we have to have 6 feet distance between each other in public life, and we have to wear the stupid masks on our faces, which do absolutely nothing. So in the next phase of litigation, we're going to be challenging the mask mandate which is riddled with exceptions, by the way, for favorite activities, and the social distancing regime, which is absolute nonsense. I mean, who came up with this idea that people have to stand 6 feet away from each other when they're in public? I mean, if you stand 6 feet away from someone and then you move along the sidewalk, for example, you're moving into the same airspace that was occupied by the person you were 6 feet away from. So you're walking into this mist of virus wherever you are. So the 6 foot rule makes no sense. All it does is destroy social order.
Well, Chris, by the way, this Father Burfitt you mentioned, is that Father Trevor Burfitt?
It's Trevor Burfitt of the Society of St. Pius X.
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but you were at the baptism of my youngest daughter, Regina, and she was baptized by Father Burfitt.
Yeah, we thought so. We hadn't actually confirmed that, but we remember that.
Yeah.
That's right. And he is a natural, by the way, for this kind of role in litigation.
Oh, because first of all, he has a very, unlike you and me, frankly, he has a very, very calm temperament, right? Not excitable at all.
No. He's very good. He's done a lot of media interviews. And that was quite the breakthrough for a California state court judge. We brought the case in state court to avoid the poisonous waters of the federal judiciary. And the judge basically slam dunked the whole regime restricting churches in California.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say is the effects this has had on the way the new mass is done. This would be a little inside baseball for Catholics, but we'll say that because of social distancing, there's no sign of peace, you know, so you don't walk around the church shaking hands with everybody like an idiot. And then the other thing is they're not distributing communion under both kinds because they feel like that would be too obviously of, you know, if everybody's drinking out of the same chalice, so they're not doing that. So I consider both of those to be inadvertently good developments, even though for the wrong reason. But of course, the bad development is a lot of places they won't allow communion on the tongue, which is what you should do.
Well, strangely enough, in New York, New Jersey, and California, there's no prohibition on communion under both kinds or communion on the tongue, which is one of the many exceptions that render the whole mask mandate ridiculous anyway. And we're arguing in these cases that the mask mandate is a radical interference in religious practice in so many different ways. For example, does anyone seriously propose that a married couple should exchange vows with face diapers on? It's ludicrous. Yeah. And also, how do you exchange rings from a distance of 6 feet without some kind of mechanical extender device? That's absurd. So, obviously, weddings are exempted, just implicitly.
Yeah.
And of course, a priest, when he administers certain blessings, there has to be a laying on of hands, so that's exempted. And a priest has to be allowed to preach without a mask on because politicians are all gassing without their masks on when they speak indoors. So that's another implicit exception. So the mask mandate in terms of religious practice is a gratuitous interference. And Governor Murphy in New Jersey has made a ludicrous attempt to accommodate religion in terms of the mask mandate. So he says that the mask may be removed briefly or momentarily for a religious purpose or religious reasons. Now, that's an interesting concept. So they're going to station mask monitors in churches to shout, "That's long enough, put the mask back on." it's nonsense. And so we're arguing in New Jersey that, look, it just doesn't work. You can't impose a mask mandate during worship any more than you can impose a mask mandate during eating. Now, in New Jersey, for example, you have the restaurant exception. Restaurants are at 25% capacity, I believe, but you can have tables of eight. So think about it. You got people at tables of eight. They obviously can't wear the masks while they're eating and drinking their wine and tucking into multi-course dinners. They can talk and laugh and spit viral particles at each other across a table for as long as they please, or as long as the owner lets them sit at the table. So what sense does it make to say that people sitting in pews facing in the same direction have to wear their masks when they're there for only an hour? It doesn't make any sense at all. And, you know, people underestimate the significance of this mask mandate. It is radically disruptive, if not destructive, of social order. Everyone walking around with his face covered, we're all converted into identical drones following a ridiculous governmental command just because the government commands it. There's no real evidence that masks have done anything. In fact, after nine or almost 10 months of this nonsense, we're told that the virus is out of control. Well, obviously the mask mandate had no effect whatsoever on the so-called viral spread.
It's so funny to look at some of the charts of, and you can pick the metric. You can, it could be cases if you like that. It can be hospitalizations. It can be deaths. How many articles have been written in the mainstream media where you've got the curve starts to come down, and they say, aha, the mask did it. But then 5 months later, the curve goes up higher than it did the first time.
Right.
And there's not a word of, well, gee, maybe it's more complicated than we thought. No, they just leave it. There's no further commentary. They just leave it.
Well, they say it would have been so much worse if you hadn't had the mask.
Yeah, so non-falsifiable.
Yeah, well, it's a variation of post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this. This version is non-hoc ergo propter hoc. Not this, in other words.
But of course, it doesn't apply to them. Like, why couldn't I say, well, maybe the curve came down because it comes down at the same time everywhere because the whole thing is seasonal. And maybe that had nothing to do with the mask. So maybe you're engaged in post hoc ergo propter hoc by attributing the fall in deaths to the masks. But apparently that works only one way.
Yeah, sort of the masks, by the way. Oh, my mask protects you and your mask protects me. But it doesn't protect me from inhaling the virus. It just protects the other person when I expel it with force by coughing or sneezing. Now, that's obvious nonsense. If the mask contains the virus expelled propulsively when I sneeze or cough, why doesn't it protect me when I'm just walking around breathing normally and the virus is not being expelled in my direction? I'm just, you know, picking it up in the surrounding air. So the one-way mask theory is nonsense. And the reason they devised that theory, that the mask only works one way, it's a source control, is because there's no evidence that masks do anything to limit the spread of a virus. And they have to admit that. So they say, basically, even though you're not protected by your mask, somehow your mask protects the other guy. Absolute nonsense. This is not science. It's voodoo. I think you called it a rain dance somewhere.
Yeah. And then the rain comes and they pat themselves on the back for it. But yeah. Now you have a whole society, at least half of society, if not more, who you would think after months and months and months of wearing masks, they would think, I'm not so sure this really does anything. But instead, they think it's the 1.3% of the public that doesn't always wear them that's really driving it. You know, it's just crazy.
Well, you've got to keep the masks on people's faces because when the epidemiological data no longer really show that this was, in fact, it never was, the bubonic plague, people begin to wonder, why am I abiding by these lockdowns? So if you can keep the masks on people's faces, you maintain the sense that there's something terribly amiss, that the very air is teeming with virus. You've got to keep these masks on so that even when the data no longer support the lockdowns, the masks maintain the mentality of the lockdown.
Yeah.
That's why there's such frenetic insistence on mask wearing by Democrat politicians. This really cuts, remarkably enough, across party lines. I remember seeing a video of one of these left-wing demonstrators screaming at a cop, where's your mask? Put on a mask. Why don't you wear it? Wear the mask. Put the mask on. Here, I have some masks here. They're free. I'll give it to you. Put it on. Put it on. Just insanely insisting that this cop put the mask on. So the cop takes the box of masks and flips it behind his head, which is the response that all of us should have to this at this point. I mean, 9 months of this nonsense should be enough to demonstrate this is nothing more than a governmental imposition on freedom for the sake of restricting our liberty and maintaining the mentality of the lockdown.
But then to make the gaslighting complete, the people who are going to lecture you about it the most are the ones who claim to be speaking in the name of science. You know, I'm following the science. No, you're actually not. You're actually not. That phrase is almost never used in the service of real scientific facts. It's always used to support superstition. Every time.
Well, in the complaints we filed, especially the one in California, we detail basically the consensus before, let us say, April of 2020, that masks are simply ineffective, even in a hospital setting, by the way, Tom, at limiting the spread of influenza-like illnesses. And the COVID-19 is an influenza-like illness by definition. Even Deborah Birx said as much. So the consensus was suddenly reversed in April. You remember the famous Jerome Adams tweet? Hey, people, stop buying masks. They're not effective. That was in April. He's telling people in the official tweet, stop buying masks. They're not effective in limiting the spread of COVID-19. Elsewhere, he said they can even increase your risk of spreading COVID-19 because the surfaces are contaminated. You keep fiddling with them, and then you touch your face, and whatever's on the surface of the mask gets transferred into your nose or some other part of your mouth, and you actually infect yourself. In fact, all of the guidance on masks says, when you take them off, don't touch them. In fact, the New York guidance says, if you take your mask off, don't leave it where anybody could pick it up. So you have this contaminated object that you can't even touch when you remove it, but you're expected to slap it on your face and walk around with it for 6 to 8 hours a day. It's absolute lunacy.
Hey, folks, let's take a brief moment to thank our sponsor, Harry's, the official razor of The Tom Woods Show. If in 2021 you have not resolved to take better care of yourself, well, doggone it, you darn well should. I forgot my Harry's razor when I was in the Virgin Islands last week, so I bought some generic brand at the airport. I don't know how people do this. It felt like I was undergoing surgery without anesthesia. Where was that beautiful, smooth glide from my Harry's blade and that amazing close shave I have taken for granted? Harry's is a return to the essential, quality craftsmanship at a fair price. They combine a simple ergonomic design with 5 sharp blades. They source their steel from Sweden and manufacture their blades in their world-class factory in Germany. Well, Harry's has a special offer for listeners of my show. New customers can get a Harry's starter set for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. You'll get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover, all for just $3. Get everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Go to harrys.com/woods to claim your offer. Tell us about, obviously there have been a whole bunch of cases related to this. There have been businesses that have fought back, not nearly as many as I would have expected, but there have been some businesses that have fought back. And there have been some judges that have sounded sympathetic or that have said there doesn't seem to be any scientific basis for this particular restriction. And you were telling me an email that, from what you've seen, some of the Trump appointees have actually been pretty good on stuff like this.
No, the decisions they render are just common sense. Here's the essence of what they say. We don't care how bad you say the pandemic is. They always bring in the attorneys general who defend these COVID-19 regimes. There are a boatload of statistics about surging cases. Again, that's just unreliable PCR test results. It's the end of the world. It's the apocalypse. And I remember arguing in California, and this is what the Trump judges are saying. Well, how is it that it's not the apocalypse at Walmart? And why is there no apocalypse at Costco? And why is there no apocalypse on the trains and planes that are packed with people, or the meatpacking plants, or the liquor stores, or the big box stores? There's no apocalypse there. So only it's when you get to the question of whether people can go to church, do we come in with the apocalyptic rhetoric. So what the Trump judges are saying is, look, the issue is not how bad the pandemic is. We're not here to debate statistics or your prophecies of doom. Even if the epidemic is as bad as you say, you still have to treat churches on an equal basis with favored businesses. So we're arguing in all of these cases, yeah, that's very nice that you say this is the apocalypse, but even during the apocalypse, you can't treat churches disparately in comparison with favored businesses. It's really that simple. And that's what the Trump judges are saying. You know, it's good for Costco, it's good for church. That's the bottom line here.
I want to read something that I posted on Twitter. Yes, I know, but there are different theories on this. I have a friend, Michael Rechtenwald. You would find him very interesting, Chris. I actually think he was in seminary for some time, and he became a Marxist. I don't know if the two things are connected, but he was a Marxist for most of his academic career at NYU. And then in the past probably 4 to 5 years, very rare for somebody in his probably late 50s, had a complete transformation of his ideology. He is now on the warpath against all these people, and he's 100% with us on things that matter. And Rechtenwald has this theory that, yes, we should move onto platforms that aren't going to, you know, that can at least stand the sight of us and are less likely to kick us off. But he thinks that if we have a beachhead in enemy territory, we should keep it. Like, if you're on Twitter, keep it. Just stay there. It couldn't hurt. So anyway, that's a theory. I understand people who just boycott. I don't even care. I just want to reach people. And on Twitter the other day, I wrote this. The way the history books, especially school textbooks, will cover the past 4 years will be entirely fictional. Russiagate, COVID, the alleged effectiveness of lockdowns, the, quote, very fine people, hoax, etc. a non-sociopath should write an authentic chapter and post it online. In other words, this chapter of your history book is going to be so laughable that you might as well not even read it. I suppose it's not that different from the other chapters in your book, but this one in particular, I feel like it's going to be especially in the realm of fantasy. So somebody needs to write a substitute chapter and just have it. 2020chapter.com. Just buy that, put it up there so that kids can read it. But what I wanted to ask you about is just to take the last few minutes to reflect on the significance of this moment. Yeah, I know. You know that one of the things I do for a living is find standard historical narratives and poke holes in them. So it's not like this is new to me that there would be distortions of events, but I feel like, I don't think it's just me. I think this is on a whole different level. I feel like there isn't going to be anything worth reading in the way any mainstream commentator covers the last 4 years because of the crazy agenda they have and the just their bizarre inability to think clear. It's not even that they can't think clear. They don't want to think clearly. They want to portray things in a certain way. I mean, what do you think about living in this world?
Well, we've always known about the liberal bias of the media. I've been following politics since the age of 18, and I have never seen anything like this. It's gone so far beyond bias that it's almost impossible to describe, except to say this. Moving far beyond bias, they're now just constructing entire narratives that have no resemblance to the real world. And then the narrative becomes your news. So the Russiagate thing. When we first heard that Trump was accused of colluding with Russia, anyone with any sense knew that that was a total crock. I mean, what does it even mean to say that he colluded with Russia? They never really defined collusion with Russia, but the narrative was an invention. And that invention became the 24-hour news cycle for years. They just made it up. There was nothing to it. The COVID-19 narrative, same thing. Right now we're seeing claims in the news that cases are surging, but they're not cases. We don't have 25 million cases of COVID-19 in the United States. They're deliberately conflating the difference between a test result, which is unreliable to begin with, especially if you're running 40 cycles of the PCR test, and an actual clinical illness. They're pretending that 25 million people have come down with COVID-19 when it isn't the case. So that's an entirely fictional narrative. And now we're getting just all fictional narratives all the time. There is no more news, really. It's just a series of narratives that bear no resemblance to reality. That is something new. As I say, it's not bias anymore. It's just basically a Pravda, American Pravda.
Well, given that, you know, look, I grew up as a kid, I grew up in the 80s. And so I grew up under Ronald Reagan. And yeah, a lot of people didn't like Ronald Reagan. And some of them really didn't like Reagan. But I never got the sense that, a little teenage kid, what do I know? But I still never got the sense that there was beneath the surface just an unremitting hostility between two irreconcilable groups of people. I never had that feeling. I felt like, well, some people really, really think we need to raise taxes to fund some social programs. That was really about it. And this has been transformed within my lifetime to the point where I feel like I'm watching companies saying they're not going to process payments for this or that group or this or that individual, even the president of the United States. And I don't know what the future has in store for me. And this all happened over the course of my lifetime. And so then the question becomes, well, the thing is, our side, if I may speak very, very broadly when speaking of our side, we're not the protesting type. We're not the organizing and conniving type. We're not the cabal type. We don't do those things. We're not, because we're not sinister and because we don't have the time. Or the desire. We want to live normal lives. We want to focus on hearth and home, all the specific duties we have according to our states in life. That's the way normal people think. We're not suited to this. But yet we've been thrust into this position that either we learn how to organize and defend ourselves fast, or I fear a very grave future. So either we just retreat and just focus on just getting our own kids through this crazy world. It's either that, or we have a wide-scale kind of resistance. I don't know, do you think of a third option? And of those two, which one do you choose?
Well, you've got to speak the truth in season and out of season. There's no doubt about that, no matter what happens in the world. But this is something new in terms of Trump, the great disruptor. You know, American politics never really offered much of a choice. It ran the gamut from A to B. You have liberals and not quite as liberals. You have the liberals saying, let's plunge into the abyss, and the so-called conservatives saying, not so fast. Let's back off a little bit from the abyss. Well, when Trump came along, as far as I can see, he was the first true outsider to get elected to the presidency. He really was beholden to nobody. Granted, he's a billionaire reprobate with a sordid past in terms of his sexual behavior. But somehow, he fastened onto this constituency of the forgotten Americans, pretty much pro-life, pretty much pro-American, patriotic types, and he got himself elected. That was a major unexpected development for the powers that be. He inched us back from the abyss, and he began to make it clear that this really was something different in American politics, a real alternative, a real movement for a significant difference. And I know a lot of apolitical people who had given up on the American system became Trump supporters because of this obvious differential between his presidency and everything that came before him, just in terms of judicial appointments, for example. So it turned out that Trump has been hated by all the right people to a depth and a breadth that we have never seen before. Literally, every power that be, all the forces of the world, whether it be in the media, in politics, big pharma, big business, were arrayed against this one man, this one frail vessel. And that is something unprecedented. He wasn't supposed to be there. It was as if the immune system of this whole rotten, corrupt civilization that is collapsing because of its own immorality was trying to expel this foreign body. They wanted him out, and now he is out. So that's something unique. This is much more than the hostility we saw toward Ronald Reagan or Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, and in fact, the sorts of people who would have this reaction to him are the kind who would say, oh, if only we could have responsible Republicans back like John McCain and George W. Bush and Mitt Romney. And so another tweet I put out was, well, everybody, don't worry, okay? Don't panic, because I'm sure Mitt Romney will stand firm against the leftist mob that can't stand the sight of you. I'm sure we can count on old Mitt, you know, who will fold at the first instance. The Mitt who'd be part of the mob, in all likelihood. Chris, what is, if people want to follow what you do, in particular, to know about the Thomas More Society, the legal side of what you do, because you also are a commentator, what's the website?
It's thomasmoresociety.org, 10 and more.
Okay.
And they have a little bio of me there and a very flattering picture. I wish I looked that good now, but anyway, I'll take it. And so I do work for them as special counsel. And, you know, I write for The Remnant and other traditionalist publications. So that's where I'm at these days.
Well, that photo thing just reminds me of a joke. You and I were at a conference. And you remember every once in a while, people would mistake us for each other because we had a very basic resemblance. So I got up at the podium and I said, all right, listen, there's a little bit of a problem here. Some of you are actually going up to one of us and thinking it's the other and you're mistaking us for each other. And I just want to clarify that Chris is a much older man. So if that helps you at all.
Not that I look it.
No. You look fantastic and never better.
You look marvelous.
Well, listen, Chris, I really, really appreciate that. I think this was just fantastic. I'm so glad we did it. And keep fighting and let's do it again.
Fine with me. Take care, Tom.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow on the show, Michael Rechtenwald, whom I just mentioned in this very episode, is joining us to talk about the Great Reset. We've heard this phrase, and I know some people think this must be some conspiracy theory, this can't be real. Well, Michael's been spending some time looking into that, so I think you're going to appreciate that. Then after that, it's going to be an episode on the fiasco in California, which is, I don't know what to say other than it's a total fiasco, everything in that state right now. And then early next week, we're going to get Dan McCarthy, who's increasingly becoming a favorite on the show, who is editor of the venerable conservative journal Modern Age, just to assess the current political situation and the crazy developments of the past couple of weeks. I think he would be particularly helpful as a commentator on that. So we got some great episodes coming up. Make sure you subscribe to The Tom Woods Show at tomwoods.com/apple to make sure all these episodes show up automatically on your device. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.